In this interview, we head to Washington State to talk with a young bishop and his wife.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, your host, and will be until somebody kicks me out of this chair. Now, if you're new to Leading LDS, this is a podcast and platform that we put together to help enhance the leadership ability in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And if you've been listening to this podcast for a while and don't realize that we actually have a website and a blog with articles and further information, all the information isn't put through the podcast, so I encourage you to visit leadinglds.org and type in some search terms there related to your calling and see what comes up. I think you'll be pleased with some of the information and direction you find there. Now, I'm getting ahead of schedule on these interviews, which I'm very excited about. I want to get a month or 6 weeks out, and so that I'm not rushing each week to get the new episode posted. And that way you can always count on an episode from Leading LDS. And we have some great interviews coming up, so I think you'll be pleased with the future of Leading LDS and some of the content you hear on this podcast. So as always, I'm trying to keep these introductions short. So we'll jump into the interview with Mark and Lacey Sivercrop in Ephrata, Washington. And here they are. How are you, Mark and Lacey?
We're doing good. How are you?
Good. And how is it, you say, the city of your town there?
Ephrata.
Ephrata. All right. That'll probably be the last time I mentioned it on the episode, but that's fine. Right. So where is Ephrata related to a city that most people would recognize?
Ephrata is right in the middle of the state. So I always joke that there's no trees and there's no Starbucks. Well, there is one Starbucks, but it's not what most people think. It's right in the middle between Seattle and Spokane. So
very good. Yeah. Cool. And were you, Mark, were you born and raised there?
Yes. Yep. Nice. Been here my whole life.
Nice. And Lacey, what about you? Where are you from?
The same, from Ephrata.
Oh, nice. High school sweethearts? Is that what's happening here?
No, we didn't start dating. We didn't start hanging out and dating until after my mission. So,
okay. So Lacey, tell us the story. How did you two meet and marry?
We met through a mutual friend. I knew him in high school, but we didn't associate with each other.
She thought it was cute.
Not in high school, after high school. Okay. And then we met, and then before, like maybe a month before his mission, we started hanging out and I liked him, but all he could talk about was his ex-girlfriend. So I was like, well, never mind.
Oh my goodness. Nice.
So, and then he went on his mission, and then I emailed him back when probably about the day you got back from your mission. Yeah. And then I think 2 days later we hung out and it's history.
The rest sparks history. Flew. And yeah. So how long ago did you marry?
Almost 9 years ago.
Great. Great. And you were sealed in, was it a Washington temple? I'm trying to think.
Well,
we were married civilly first because both of our families aren't members. So We got married civilly first, and then we got sealed in the Columbia River temple.
Oh, awesome. So are you both converts then?
We are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And, did you both, how old were you, Mark, when you got baptized?
I started going to church when I was like 16, and I got baptized when I was 18. It was like 3 weeks before I graduated from high school. I figured that way, if my parents kicked me out, then I was out of school. So I could just go live somewhere else and go to college and be good. So
your parents weren't overly excited about this.
They
this
weren't.
Idea.
No, okay. They've warmed up since, but they were not real excited at that point in time.
Gotcha. And would you say, was it an influence of friends that was sort of the catalyst there?
It was. Yeah. I had a lot of friends that were members. My ex-girlfriend was a member of the church. So, that kind of started. And then when I came to church, I had a bunch of my friends from high school that were there. And so just started hanging out with them. And so, yeah.
Great. And Lacey, what about you? How old were you when you got baptized?
I was 19.
Okay. So roughly the same ages. I mean, a little bit, off, but and what was it friends for you as well?
Yeah, it's always, I've never noticed it growing up, but I've always had members as friends, and it's always been part of my life. I met the missionaries before when I was in high school, but it really didn't go anywhere. And then when Mark got back on his mission, I came to his homecoming, and then I met the elders, and then I, what?
So funny story about that, if I can. Okay. When the missionaries were teaching her, and it was like the second time they taught her, we were over to one of my friends, our friend's house. And they were teaching her, and they committed her to baptism, and they did the, and granted, I've been home a month for my mission at this point, so I know all the tricks, right? And so it was like, well, Lacey, you know, would you be willing to work towards being baptized on October 16th or whatever it was? And she's like, yeah, sure. You know, and the missionaries left, and I looked at Lacey, and I looked at her friends that we were at their house, and I said, you do realize you just committed to be baptized. She goes, no, I just said I'd work towards that. I said, oh no, you just committed to be baptized, and they are now jumping up and down calling their zone leaders. That's what's happening.
Nice.
So it was funny.
Great. Awesome. And so how long did you marry after you were baptized, Lacey?
A year.
Oh, okay. I mean,
just under a year.
Just under a year. Yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. And neither side of your families, have, there's not been any baptisms yet. You're just obviously praying for such things to happen.
Right. Yeah. There's no immediate family members that are, but Lacey actually had an aunt and uncle that are members in Southern Idaho. And I have since found out that there's actually a cousin. My mom's cousin is a member in our stake. I just found that out. Doing family history, we found that out. And I had another cousin that joined the church a couple years after me that, by some fluke thing, I found out from a member of the mission presidency. So, but yeah, no immediate family members as of yet.
Great. So then you guys get married, and now you've been married roughly a decade, would you say?
Just under, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And have two kids that you mentioned before we hit record.
Yes. Yeah. Two kids. Brooklyn is 7, almost 8. She turns 8 next month. And then Cash is 3. Or this month, I guess. It is September now. So right. This month, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I was going to ask you, Mark, where did you serve your mission?
I served in upstate New York, Utica, the Utica mission. So not Palmyra. I didn't have Palmyra in my mission. It was right next to it. But
and Palmyra is in the Rochester mission, right? So,
yep.
Okay. And so Utica, is it close to the border of Canada or is that more Rochester?
Utica mission? Is right in the middle of the state, but our mission covered from Syracuse all the way over to the eastern side of New York. So just past Albany. And then all the way to the Canadian border and all the way down to the Pennsylvania border.
Nice. So, and you left on your mission roughly a year after you joined the church, right?
I did. I got my mission call. I think it was just about exactly a year after my baptism. And then I left 3 months later. So.
And was that a pretty easy decision for you to make with the other friends leaving on their mission? Or
I did not plan on going on one. I was like, oh, I'm a convert. I don't have to go, you know, and I got my patriarchal blessing said that a mission was voluntary. So I'm like, oh, I'm good. I don't have to go. And then I, for whatever reason, picked up John Bytheway's book, What I'd Wish I'd Known Before My Mission.
Oh,
and
cool.
I literally remember reading the book, finishing it, setting it down and looking at it and saying, well, I guess I'm going on a mission. And I just knew. I mean, the Spirit just told me you need to go on a mission. And so I did. And I kept it from my parents until I needed to do my medical records and I needed my immunization record. And I asked my mom for it and she freaked. Uh-huh. To put it lightly, she was not happy at all. But yeah, so I mean, once the Spirit told me you're going, yeah, it was an easy decision. So
nice. And so how did that develop you in the gospel? I mean, what stands out the most as you think how your mission developed you in the gospel?
Oh my gosh. I remember before my mission hearing missionaries say, you know, return missionaries say, you know, I think of my mission every single day. I always think of my mission. I'm like that. Come on, really? Every single day. But I literally do, you know, and I think every missionary knows that. It's like, it changes who you are and it affects you so, so heavily. I remember being 3 months into my mission and thinking, I can't imagine not going on a mission. I can't imagine trying to learn the gospel as a convert without just being, you know, being able to jump in with both feet and being forced to learn and grow and develop. So it's been a huge help for me, just from learning the gospel. And, you know, since I've got home, my grandpa sometimes tries to argue about the church with me. And I just kind of smile and I'm like, really, grandpa, let's not get into this. I did this like quote unquote professionally for a while. Right. Like, there's nothing you can tell me I haven't heard before. So I think from that sense, I mean, it was just really good to just solidify that testimony and, you know, And I think a lot of ways proved to myself and the proof to my parents and a lot of other people that I didn't do it because I was dating somebody. I didn't do it because I had friends. I did it because I had a testimony. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the biggest thing for me is just that, just accelerated learning as a convert.
Yeah. Well, great. And now, now you serve as bishop of your ward. And how long have you been the bishop?
Oh, almost 2 years. 2 years in October coming up.
Nice. So you've completed another mission here. This is another 2 year mission.
Yeah, it's been weird. We have the first missionary he left the day I got called as bishop. He's coming home next month, and that's just weird to me.
Oh, great!
It's like, that's fantastic. Really? Wow.
Nice. And do you have a lot of youth? You said you've had one missionary go out, or have you had others since then?
We've had others. We have. In our town, we have three wards, and ours is the biggest as far as attendance. So yeah, we have, I think, probably just under 40 youth, probably about the same in the primary. Okay. So yeah, it's a pretty good size ward.
Good size, healthy functioning ward there.
It is.
What's the average, would you say the average attendance you have on Sunday?
Average attendance, including, we have a Spanish group that's part of our ward. So the average attendance is probably 180, 185.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great. And you were called as what would be classified as a younger bishop. I think you mentioned before you were 29 when you were called as bishop, right?
I was, yeah.
So tell us that story. What do you remember about being called as bishop? I don't think too many people expect such a calling to come, but especially when you're still in your 20s. Was that right. Common for your ward to have a younger bishop, or did it come out of nowhere?
No, it's not common at all. I mean, every other bishop I've known has been, you know, at the least late 30s. So it was surprising. I was the state clerk at the time. So I had all the members of my ward bugging me all the time saying, who's going to be the next bishop? Who, you know, they are. It's like, what do you know? Who do you know? Who's it going to be? And
who's on the list?
Right. And we'd had a conversation about that because a member of the stake presidency's in our ward too. And so as we were traveling, you know, our stake president would say, well, you know, who's the options, you know, and we'd talk through them and stuff. As we went through them, my biggest concern was I thought, the guy who became my first counselor, I thought he maybe would be called as bishop and I'd take his spot as the high councilman. Like that was my biggest worry. And I always kind of joked with people. I said, the good thing about being state clerk is there's not very many callings that you'll get taken out of state clerk for. I said, the bad thing is high councilman and bishop are probably two of them.
Yeah.
So anyways, I was kept totally out of it. Like I didn't know anything, you know, president talked to his counselors and pretty much left me out of it. And so I kept telling people, I'm like, man, I don't know anything. And then I finally told president one day, I said, president, can you just pick somebody? Like, seriously, I'm getting so tired of people asking if I know and, you know, asking if it's me. And he just kind of smiled. It was state conference weekend. And he just smiled at me and he's like, just kind of nodded. And the next day he sent me a text and he said, hey, what are you and your wife doing tonight? And I was like, well, Lacey has to work, but you know, why, what's going on? He goes, well, I'd like to talk to you tonight if I can. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm still thinking, oh no, high council or something. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he texts me again and he says, and if it's what you think it's about, you're right. And it was like, at that instant, the spirit said, you will be the next bishop. And I was like, oh my gosh. And it was like, my heart sunk. I had no appetite. And I think I was home for lunch at the time from work. And I looked at Lacey and I said, I'm going to be the bishop. And he hadn't told me that, but I just knew. And I don't think either of us like had any appetite for the rest of the day. And so we went and met with him and he extended the call and I was terrified. You know, it's like you said, it's not something you ever expect. It's all the questions of, you know, why me, you know, I'm not that old. Are people going to listen to me? You know, how am I going to do this? I still feel, even today, I still feel like I'm brand new in the gospel. I mean, I've been a member 13 years now, but I still feel sometimes that like a convert, you know? And so it was surprising to say the least and a bit overwhelming, but you know, I found that the overwhelming part ended on Wednesday when my counselors were called and I knew it wasn't just me anymore. I was okay. And so from Wednesday to Saturday, I was okay. Sunday morning, I was terrified again. Heading the church to get sustained, but I don't know. It's been quite the ride so far.
And Lacey, what thoughts went through your mind as you realized that this calling was entering your family?
Before like he told me, he was like, I'm going to be bishop. I had a feeling that something was going to happen, but I didn't know. I didn't think it was bishop. I thought maybe a counselor or something. But when we went in, the stake president asked me if it was okay if he could be the bishop. I was like, he's like, are you okay if I called him? I'm like, yeah, you know. And when I said that, it was kind of like a comforting when I, after I said, yeah, you know, but it's to this day, I'm still a little overwhelmed and just, I don't know, just a little, it's hard with my kids. Yeah. So I'm like, it was overwhelming, but peaceful too. Like for the first week, the spirit was so strong in my home that I knew it was where he was supposed to be.
And now it's been a couple of years of you, you know, sitting alone in sacrament meeting. And I've realized even with different leadership callings, you know, with being in bishoprics or in the stake presidency, there are moments where you have to sit down as a couple and sort of figure out how to make this work. Are there any, I don't know, understandings or rules that you've put in place or to help balance Mark's responsibility as bishop and his responsibility as a father and husband?
I don't know that we've ever set any rules necessarily. I think the biggest thing is just, you know, I think we kind of talked about it at the beginning of, hey, here's when meetings are and this is what's going to have to be. And, you know, I've struggled with that a little bit, not being as, you know, communicating as well as I could. I know we've had a few Sundays where it's like, oh, I have to leave at this time for meetings. And she kind of looks at me like, I didn't know that, you know, why didn't you tell me that? And so it's, so that's a continual struggle. But, you know, I think, you know, I've seen my counselors and stuff kind of struggle with, you know, being there Wednesday for mutual and stuff. And we never really have. I mean, it's always just been kind of a, well, that's what he does Wednesday. You know, he's going to be at the church from 6:30 to 8:30 or 6:30 to 9 or whatever it is. And that's just the way it is. So.
I mean, there are times where I'm like in my head, I'm like, seriously, again, but
another meeting,
you know, and I tell, you know, sometimes I like Mark really, but I have to tell him that I know it's what he's supposed to be doing. I'm just venting. Don't take it personal, you know, but.
And I think those conversations are important that wives know it's okay to say those things, right? Like you said, you're just venting. It's not like you expect him to cancel church or cancel, you know, the whole lineup of meetings. But I know in my household, sometimes my wife will look at me and say, you know, I think it's time for a good solid date night. And we try and do that weekly, but you know how sometimes you get 2 or 3 weeks, you get caught up in things. And sometimes she has to remind me, you know, we need to refocus here. And I appreciate that. But, and I hope all bishops' wives can feel like they can speak up and say something and feel like they definitely have a priority over things. So that's fantastic. So Mark, now that you're 2 years into this, what I don't want to say problems, but circumstances are there in your ward that you're constantly seeing that would kind of characterize your ward in a certain way?
Well, I think, it's interesting. I've talked to the other couple bishops in town you know, we always kind of share, you know, we talk shop a little bit and it's like, here's what I'm struggling with. Here's what I'm dealing with. And I've learned that every ward has their own challenges and they're not better or worse necessarily. They're just unique challenges. I'm very blessed that our ward doesn't have a lot of welfare issues. I do very little with the welfare issues. And the other two wards in my town do quite a bit. So I've been pretty blessed, I think, in that sense. I think my biggest challenge, and this is the one that my stake president told me when he called me, he said, your biggest challenge is going to be complacency. You know, our ward is a lot of members that have been members for a long time. They like the way things go. They like how things run. And it's not in a bad way necessarily. I'm not saying they're bad members, but just, you know, it's been the fight of, you know, getting past the, well, we've always done it this way. Well, we've always done this. Yeah. We've always done this. And saying, well, I know that's okay, but now we're going to do this. You know, now this is what the stake presidency is asking us to do. This is what, you know, the 12 are asking us to do, or this is what I feel like we should do. And, you know, I've got some pushback with that, but it hasn't been bad. I think everybody's pretty good with it, but that's been my biggest challenge is just, you know, keeping people from getting complacent, you know, encouraging them to keep trying to get better and keep, you know, doing those things that they, you know, are supposed to be doing and trying to do more. So.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, complacency is such an interesting characteristic of a ward. In my ward, where I was a bishop, you know, it's so transient. You know, I never released an auxiliary leader just because it was time to release them. I always released them because they were moving, right. You know, and so there's always this change happening. And I go up to my in-laws' ward in Southeast Idaho. You know, they live in this farm community and nothing ever changes. And it's just interesting to sit back and admire what happens, because it seems like, you know, everybody's sort of had their chance, their opportunity being bishop or served in every calling there is. And there is this feeling of complacency, like it's just the same meeting over and over again. And it is an interesting problem, because you sort of have to rattle their cage and find ways to wake them up a little bit and re-engage them. Because if they are complacent, they're not really engaged, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a, you know, that's what I feel bad sometimes when I'm talking to the other bishops, like using that as a problem because they just look at me. It's like, well, I had like 7 welfare cases I'm dealing with, or I had this that I'm dealing with, or I have these families that are feuding in my ward that I'm dealing with, or whatever it is. And I'm like, I'm just trying to get people to come to the meetings. You know, I'm just trying to get them to fulfill their callings. But it is. And I think it's a good problem to have. I mean, it means that there's not the other, you know, some other major stuff, but, it certainly is. I see it with my members that, you know, it's easy to get comfortable where you're at. And I think sometimes, you know, Satan's okay with that. He's okay with us just being complacent and not doing as much as we can. So, that's been the major focus that we've had, is just, you know, trying to get some of those things going that are maybe a little more than the bare minimum.
Yeah. And so any specific tactics or approaches you've tried to combat that complacency that have worked, that come to mind?
I think, I'm trying to think of something for that specifically. One of the things that we really focused on is trying to do a lot better job at, training and making sure people have the tools to succeed. And especially with our youth, like that's one of the things we've really focused on is, you know, making sure that we're, you know, allowing our youth leaders to lead, you know, our quorum leaders and our class leaders, to lead and not just doing it for them. Because I think that was one of the complacency things. It was, you know, it's kind of like as a parent, it's easier to just go clean your kid's room than it is to go help them clean the room, you know, or go do it for them. You know, it's like, it's easiest just to do it. It's harder to say, hey, let's go do this. And so that's been the challenge that, you know, we've been working on is, you know, instead of just doing it for them, let's help the quorum leaders, let's help the class leaders to plan their Sunday stuff, to plan some activities for Wednesdays, to, you know, have them be the ones to call their quorum or class members to let them know what's going on. And so I think it's just that kind of that delegation and just, you know, empowering people to fulfill their callings and, expecting them to do so. And then, you know, trying our best to do the whole return and report and ask him how it's going.
Yeah, that's great. So Lacey, I want to bounce back to you for a minute here. I'm curious to know, before we jump into the 5 leadership principles, which is customary on the How I Lead segment, but I always reminded my wife, you know, when I was bishop, that being the bishop's wife is sort of an unofficial calling, right? And there's certain example and role that goes along with that. How do you sort of see yourself acting in that role as bishop's wife, week to week as you're in church and that sort of thing?
I'm not your typical bishop wife. I am very,
okay.
I'm very shy. I'm not a very outgoing person unless I really know you. I mean, I make sure I say hi to people, you know, a friendly face, but and I'll do anything anybody asks, but
I think that's been the hardest thing for.
I can't go out of my way to go, you know, oh, there's investigators. It's hard for me to be like, hi, I'm Lacey, you know, and
yeah,
but
yeah, well, that's great. That's great. And I know sometimes we feel like, you know, we see that, you know, politician wives who are, you know, chiseled in a certain way and very diplomatic. And we sort of feel like, oh, well, if my husband is a dynamic leader, I've got to be this dynamic, well-spoken, outgoing leader. But sometimes that's not the case, right? With the bishops and bishops' wives and sometimes the bishop is really quiet and the wife is more outgoing or vice versa. And, but nonetheless, you just, I love how you say, just offer that simple smile and you're there, you're present. And sometimes being present and showing that example is the most, or half the battle, you know? So Well, let's pivot into the principles, as I generally do on the How I Lead segment. Is I ask you to send me some, you know, five principles that you live by or lead by, and let's just go through these and see what we can learn from them. The first one you mentioned is delegate a lot. Focus on doing what only I can do. Elaborate, Mark.
I kind of joked. I told my counselors when we had our first meeting, I said, okay, well, I served with President Walker and he's like the primo delegator in the church. So be prepared. You know, my stake president is an amazing delegator. I mean, literally I can count on one hand the number of times he conducts a meeting because he doesn't have to. So he delegates it to his counselors. And, you know, I just learned from him that there's enough that you have to do, that delegate everything else. And so that, I think that's the one thing that's allowed me, to not like go crazy, I think, is being able to delegate to my counselors, but also to the organizations and to just say, hey, I trust you to do this. Just go do it. You know what you need to do. One of the things I've learned is most people know what they're supposed to do, but the minute that you take that away from them, then they sit back and they say, well, you know, Bishop's just going to change it anyways. And then they don't do it anymore. And I've been very fortunate to have counselors that have been, you know, have kind of pushed me on that and said, hey, you know, let us do more. Let us, you know, you don't need to be doing this every time. You don't, you know, you don't have to be, you know, at every baptism. You don't have to conduct every meeting. You don't have to do these things. We can help with that. And anytime I feel bad about it, they remind me, hey, some of the stuff that only you can do, we don't want to do. We don't want any part of the, you know, the confessions and the working through, morality issues and doing those types of things. So it's okay. You know, we don't want to do the welfare stuff. So, that's been one of the things that's been really helpful to me is just understanding that and being okay with saying, nope, I trust you to do it. And, I've learned that that's a challenge sometimes depending on who is the bishop before you. Because, you know, if they're more of a hands-on and the last bishop is super awesome and I love him, but he was more of the one that it was just easier for him to just go do it real quick. So he would just do it. And when I first got called, I had organizations like, I got a call one time and it was like, hey, this family needs, you know, coats for their kids to start school. What should we do? And I just looked at it and I was like, go get the coats. Call your organization, see if anybody can donate some. It's like, you know, that this is something we need, you know, it's okay. Just go do it, you know, and let me know afterwards that you did it. I don't need to make these little decisions. And, you know, so I think that's been one of the biggest things is just kind of letting go of some of those things and just empowering people and saying, just, you know, hey, I trust you to do it. Just go do it. And if you have questions, feel free, but you know, you can talk to my counselors. You can, you know, I delegate a lot of the interviewing to my counselors. I delegate a lot of, you know, conducting meetings and those types of things. I mean, we rotate who conducts our ward councils and our PECs and, you know, I look at that as not only does it take the burden off of me of doing it, but it allows my counselors to be the authority figure, you know, and to, so when they're out with the ward, you know, people will take what they say a little more seriously. It's not, well, you know, the bishop always leads these meetings, so I'm just going to wait to see what he says. You know, if they're the ones answering questions and they're the ones, you know, providing counsel and providing direction, then it's going to make it easier for them to do their job and for them to help me. So I think everything really kind of rests on that. If you don't learn to delegate, then you can't get everything done. You just can't.
Yeah. And there are those things, you know, that the bishop has on their plate that other members don't know about that they probably could delegate. You know, those are things that are important, but I like how you say those, a lot of those things is the, you know, giving permission to individuals who bring that task or that item to you and looking for a solution and empowering them to say, you know what, I trust you. Why don't you just go solve the problem? You know, probably better how to get children coats than I do. So why don't you just go handle that? Right.
Yeah.
So what are the things that, obviously there's the, you know, obviously the bishop responsibilities from the handbook that only the bishop can do, but are there other specific things that you definitely reserve for yourself that you feel like you're having a greater impact doing yourself as a leader?
One of the things that we've done is we talked, my counselors and I, about the youth. And I was really struggling with the fact that, you know, the church's recommendation is that the bishop interviews, you know, the 16, the 18 year olds, every 6 months, and they interview the 12 to 16 year olds every year. And then their counselor interviews the other 6 months. And I just didn't feel like that was enough. Like I was meeting with youth and I was committing them to read more and to pray or to, you know, do whatever it was. And then there was no follow-up and there was no, you know, return and report basically. And so what we've done is I've made it a point that I interview our youth a lot more frequently. I interview the 12 to 16 year olds every 6 months. And that's what I do. And then my counselors interview them 3 months in between. And I interview the 16 to 18 year olds every 2 months. And so that's one of the things that, as I've delegated some of the other stuff that I feel is really important is getting close to the youth and talking to them frequently. And it's been kind of fun. When I first got called, I was talking to one of the youth in my ward that was, I think, 16 at the time. And I said, well, this is just your annual bishop's interview. And she said, I've never had one of those. And I was just like, wait, what? You know, and I think it's easy. It's easy to miss those things.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's been fun because I've actually had a couple youth recently that I've talked to as we've implemented this, you know, every 2 months thing for the older youth that have said, didn't we just talk? And I'd say, yeah, it's been about 2 months. It's time to talk again. And so that's been one of the things that I've really focused on. And I think it's really important is just talking to them, getting to know them, getting to know what they're doing, following up on commitments we've made or they've made, and then just being able to have that relationship when they're not in trouble, when they didn't do something wrong, so that it's not a bad thing to talk to the bishop, you know, because I think that's such a typical thing that everybody's like, oh no, I got to talk to the bishop. This is, you know, something bad's happening. I'm getting a calling or I did something wrong and I don't want it to be that way. I want it to be, you know, a friendship and I want it to be a, you know, an encouraging thing that they don't mind doing it. So I think that's probably the biggest one that I've really focused on doing that I think's probably most important for me is just, you know, being close to them and talking to them frequently.
Yeah. And that leads perfectly into your second principle, which is focus on individuals, connecting with members one-on-one. I mean, is there more to say on that principle that you haven't already said?
Well, I think it's just, you know, by extension for the rest of the ward. I mean, we've really realized, wow, that was fantastic English right there, man. We've realized that nothing happens unless you're focusing on the individual. We had a conversation in work council a few months ago where we talked about the fact that everything we want to do in the church doesn't work if you're trying to do it to a quorum or to a group or to a family even. It has to be at the individual level. You know, if you want to increase, you know, home teaching, you have to be doing your PPIs. If you want to increase, you know, your youth spirituality and whatnot, you have to be interviewing them. If you want, you know, you want to help a member of your quorum to do whatever, to either, you know, stop doing something or take the next step to be, you know, temple worthy or whatever it is, then you have to talk to that individual one-on-one. And just realizing that that's what the Savior taught. And that's where the power comes from. There's a quote by, he's an evangelical preacher. And I heard him say one time, Andy Stanley, he said, do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. And that's something that I really try to do. It's like, you know, I can't meet every member. I can't, you know, go to every member's house all the time. I can't, you know, talk to everybody every week. But when I do talk to somebody, I try to do for them what I wish I could do for everybody. And as you do that, I think that's where the spirituality of the ward increases. That's where the youth become more active. That's where home teaching and visiting teaching increases, when you're focusing on those individuals and trying to encourage them and give them the tools that they need, because then that ripples. And even if you're not doing it with somebody else, they see you doing it with that person. And by extension, they know that if you were talking to them, you would do the same thing with them. So that's
awesome.
That's what our focus is for that.
That's great. I love that do for one quote, because I'm realizing that in the stake prison scene, I've mentioned this in another episode, but when I go and visit wards, it's just so overwhelming, especially that first year when I really didn't know people in the stake and other wards. And so I'd show up and, you know, here I am supposed to be this leader that doesn't know anybody. And so I'd want to be like, okay, well, I've got to learn everybody's name in the stake. And so when I see him, I can say their name, whatever. But now I just sort of go to a sacrament meeting, sit there, and I pick out one individual, one family that after the meeting, I can go down and just literally spend 5 minutes, like not set the goal to shake everybody's hand in the room, but shake the goal to connect with one individual or one family in the room. And I found that that's so much more valuable as I connect with that individual and doing for that one family what I wish I could do for everybody. You know,
right.
It's a strong principle.
Yeah.
Next principle, you say, stick with the brethren. I think that's wise counsel. What do you mean?
I can't remember. I remember hearing the Hubie Brown quote where that's what he said was, you know, that was his counsel, was to stick with the brethren. And I think, you know, there's so many times that, you know, we have the doctrine of the church and then we have the culture of the church, and they're not always the same. And people get these ideas and it's easy to kind of start facing the wrong way. And, you know, yeah. worrying about, you know, some families having some issue or whatever. But I think the most important thing, especially from a leadership standpoint, is to understand what, you know, what the quorum of the 12 and the leaders of the church, and, you know, by extension, the 70 and the stake presidency and what they want, and then stick with that. You know, one of the things that I try really hard to do is when I get a question from one of my auxiliary leaders is, you know, like, hey, how do we do this? Or what do we do for this? Or, you know, we want to do this for mutual or whatever it is. My first question to him is, what does the handbook say? You know, they've provided these resources of here's how it should be done. You know, if you stick to that, and if you stick to what, you know, the counsel you're given by the leaders of the church, then you don't ever have to worry about, you know, making a wrong decision. You know, you don't have to worry about backtracking at some point. And I think that's the biggest thing for me is just if I can find solidly where, you know, what I'm doing is following the principles that have been taught by, you know, the quorum of the 12 or, you know, the stake president, or it's in the handbook, then I know I'm safe. I know that I'm not providing bad counsel. And it's easy for me to rest on that and say, look, this isn't me necessarily asking you to do this. This is the principle. Here's where it comes from. And it allows you to, I think sometimes it's hard for members because they know the bishop personally. It's easy to find fault. It's easy to say, well, you know, yes, but yes, he says this, but you know, I know the way he is, and you know, I know what he's done or whatever it is. Whereas if you're teaching the principles and you're sticking with what the quorum of the 12 and the other leaders of the church say, it's easier to say, look, this is the principle. This is what, you know, this is what Heavenly Father wants us to do, because this is what the brethren have said. And so I think that's just so important, is to remain grounded in that. And if you do that, then everything else kind of falls into place.
Yeah, that's great. Number four, you say train, train, train. Three important leadership words, right?
That's right. I, you know, this was one, we had a auxiliary leader that we'd called, and it was a couple months later, and they weren't really doing what I had hoped they would. And I was getting really frustrated, you know, and you know, we joked about this before we started recording, Kurt, that, you know, every once in a while I joke that one of my leadership principles was going to be, don't say what you're thinking, because I would get frustrated. And it's just like, you know, part of you wants to shake the person and say, why the heck aren't you doing what you're supposed to be doing? And then I sat back and I started thinking about it, and I said, does he know what he's supposed to be doing? Have I sat down and said, this is what I expect. These are the things that we're focused on. These are the things that I would like to see. What do you think we should be doing? And having that conversation. And I really realized that, you know, I can't really blame somebody for not doing what I think they should have been doing if I didn't tell them what I thought they should be doing in the first place. And I really believe that, you know, 90, 95% of the members in our wards want to be doing the right thing. They want to fulfill their callings. They want to be successful. They want to feel the Spirit. But if we don't take the time to sit down with them and say, you know, here's what you should be doing. Here's what, as a bishopric, our goals are. Here's how that fits in. What do you think you should be doing? Here's some resources you can use. Here's the website for this. Here, did you know about LDS tools? Did you know about this? Do you know that there's training videos? Then we can't really blame them when they don't do it. And so we've tried really hard, and we're not perfect at it, but we've tried really hard when we call a new auxiliary leader to sit down with him. And we put together a couple pages where it's like, okay, here's some highlights. And I've even delegated that. There's delegation again. I delegate that to my counselors if it's the organization they're over. So if it's, say, the young men's, when we call them, my counselor that's over the young men sits down with them and says, here's what the bishopric's goals are. Here's, you know, what the meetings that you're, that we're expecting you to attend. Here's the times that those meetings are. You know, here's, you know, yearly meetings like the, you know, stake leadership or whatever. Here's some resources you can use. Here's, you know, and then we talk about it. And as we've done that, we found that it works better. It's not perfect. We haven't, you know, we don't have perfect leaders by any means, but I feel like as we train better, then it's a lot closer. And at least at the very least, you have something to come back to if they're not doing what you expected that they would do, and say, okay, did we misunderstand what the expectations were? Was I not clear on what I was hoping you would do? And then we can have that conversation. Whereas if you never have that conversation to begin with, I mean, you can't really blame them when they don't do what they didn't know you wanted them to do. So that's why I think that's so important. Though we do.
Absolutely.
We always want to. We always want to blame them, even if it was just in our minds, but you can't.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And a few thoughts came to mind as you were discussing this is, you know, in the stake presidency, sometimes we'll get a bishop or a ward leader coming to us and say, hey, you know, I have this counselor and is there any stake calling you could put them in? It's just probably not a good fit. And I start inquiring about why their current calling isn't a good fit and come to find out that this leader hasn't even talked to them about it, right? Or discussed it. They're just sort of disappointed. And so the easy way out is to just find a new calling and maybe they'll figure that calling out better than this calling. But this is one of the most, underrated leadership skills is just that ability to sit down with somebody and discuss expectations with them and what their role is. And that can be so powerful. And we've got to give, you know, this ties back to your other principle, focusing on individuals. We have to give the individual a chance because just changing the calling, if we don't give them a chance to figure it out, it can have a lasting negative impact on them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you're talking about sitting down with auxiliary leaders and kind of going through, okay, here's the training involved and here's what you can do. You know, it makes me think about the keys that the bishop holds, right? And there's certain inspiration that's going to come to the bishop that auxiliary leader, that individual doesn't know that applies to their calling, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's easy in the church. We have all these auxiliaries, all these callings, like, okay, you're the family history person. So you go in that corner and you turn that family history wheel and then, okay, you're in, you know, elders quorum. So you go in that elders quorum corner and spin that wheel for a while. But really what we should be doing is going to the bishop or having the bishop articulate what's the focus of the ward so that we can all spin the same wheel in our own capacities, right?
Right.
And that does not come, that does not happen unless that training happens or that communication happens, which is really, you know, when we say it, it's like, sure, I can go talk to an individual, but when you sit down in that office and trying to, you know, explain and talk through expectations, it sometimes gets awkward because you don't want the person to feel like they've failed or they're not living up to par, you know? And so, but really crucial. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. I think that's why it's easier to do it at the beginning is then there's no, I failed. But even if they have, I mean, I think, you know, when I've had those conversations, I started it with, I'm sorry, I don't think I was clear with my expectations and that's not your fault.
Yeah.
You know, you were doing what you thought you should be doing, but you know, it comes back to with the delegation and with all of this, I mean, my view of it is, my goal with these leaders is to prepare them for the next calling that they have. And so you're right. When you just move them on to another one and maybe that one's going to catch somehow, that doesn't help with that. You know, I tell my counselors all the time, my goal is by the end of the 5 years that either of you are prepared and able to become the bishop if that's what the Lord wants. You know, I'm very proud of the fact that I look around my ward in the last couple of years and I see several people that I don't know that they would have been prepared for certain callings, but now they would be. I would not hesitate. You know, I have some people that, you know, 2 years ago, if somebody would have said, hey, I'm going to put that person as elders quorum president, I would be like, oh, I don't know if they, you know, they haven't had the experience to do that. And, you know, I really like the fact that I can look at some of those individuals now and say, yeah, they could do that. You know, they've had those opportunities. They've been taught, they've been trained to where they can understand because none of us, you know, wake up in the morning and are capable of doing the callings that we have. But, you know, I firmly believe if we do these things the way we're supposed to, if we train them and help them and guide them and mentor them, that, you know, Heavenly Father does prepare us. You know, he does give us those opportunities to learn what we need to know for the next calling that he has for us. And so, you know, I think that's why it's so important to train and to make sure that you help them to make those decisions. And I had so many times, and this is where I started to realize that I was kind of off track, is I would get frustrated because I'm like, well, why isn't the young men's presidency training my young men's council president? You know, why isn't the high councilman working with my elders quorum president? Why isn't the young women's presidency helping them to do this? And I stopped and I thought, and I'm like, yeah, it is the stake's responsibility to do some training. But when it comes right down to it, it's my responsibility. You know, it's the ward's responsibility. It's the bishopric's responsibility. And if I start trying to outsource that, then, you know, nobody gets anything done because I'm just blaming and it doesn't work. So we really try to just take that and say, you know what? Yeah, I really do hope that the young men's presidency or the young women's presidency or the high councilman does the training that they're supposed to be doing and that I know the stake president's asking them to. But if they don't, then they're going to get trained anyways. We're going to make sure they're trained. I'm not going to rest it on whether somebody else is doing their responsibility. I'm just going to make sure it gets done. And that way it's done. So
the last principle you mentioned is show appreciation.
I don't even know if Lacey knows that I do this, but every couple of weeks, every month or so, I sit down and I write a thank you note to somebody in the ward. And sometimes it's a few, sometimes there's a reason, you know, after a girls camp or something, I'll send them to the young women's leaders and just tell them I appreciate their work. But I try to keep my mind open to the people that are doing things and just, you know, not broadcast it to everybody, but just send them a note and say, I really appreciate your dedication. I appreciate what you've done. I appreciate your testimony. And just let them know, because I think a lot of times, you know, showing that appreciation does more for helping people to want to do more and to contribute more and to, you know, grow in the gospel than anything else we can do. I think it's easy to stand up and say, we should be doing this and we should be doing that. But I think if people, if people love you as a leader and they appreciate you, they're more willing to do what you ask them to do. And that's the only way it really works. And so I try really hard to do that. And it's kind of funny. I was thinking, I have my financial clerk. I try really hard with my clerks and my counselors to tell them that I appreciate them. You know, it's like, hey, I appreciate what you do. Thanks for staying. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for working through the audit, you know, whatever it is. And one of the neatest things for me is it's kind of a game with my financial clerk now. Like, he'll try to tell me that he appreciates me before I tell him I appreciate him. And I think just that mentality and that mindset of recognizing that these people are just like me, and they've got families and they've got other responsibilities and they have, you know, a million different things they need to be doing. And so when they take time and make the conscious effort to, you know, do something to build up the kingdom, to, you know, to serve members of the ward, that I think it's important that we let them know that. And, you know, it doesn't go without saying. I think a lot of times it's like, well, it goes without saying that we appreciate that. No, it doesn't. If you don't tell them, they don't know. And it's so important for people to hear that. And it's so important for, you know, especially those leaders that are spending a lot of time away from their families and they're really dedicated, to know that somebody sees that they're doing it. You know, especially when you get to like the like primary organization and some of those callings where it's like, nobody ever really sees it happening. It just happens, and they're off in their corner of the building. And so I try really hard to send thank you notes and to just let people know that I appreciate them. We were at our county fair last week, and I saw one of my members that was working in one of the food booths. And I just walked over to her, and it was funny. Another lady came up and said, can I help you? I said, oh, I just want to talk to Patty. And so Patty walks over and I said, Patty, I just want you to know, I appreciate you. I appreciate seeing you. And to see her face light up, and this is a lady, she's in her, I think, 60s, and you know, she's single, but you know, faithful member. And just to see the way her face lit up just from somebody telling her, I appreciate you. I like seeing you. I'm happy that you're here. It makes a big difference. And I think it's something that's easily overlooked because it's easy to do. And, you know, just doing those little things as a leader, I think does more for allowing you to accomplish what you want to accomplish because I didn't do it for this reason, but if I called Patty and asked her to do something, she would do it and she wouldn't think twice about it because she knows that I appreciate her. And so just having that mindset, not doing it for manipulative means, not doing it because I'm going to ask her to do something, but just doing it because you honestly do appreciate them. And I think leaders realize that. And I think everybody will understand that you really do. I mean, you have a love for the people that you're serving and the people that you're responsible for that is beyond you. It really is charity. It really is a love that is past what you could do yourself. And so it's our job as leaders just to voice that and to vocalize that. You know, I think of the scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants that talks about how the only way we offend the Lord is when we're not appreciative, when we don't show gratitude. And I think that extends to showing gratitude to the members of our ward and to the people that you know, give of their time and their talents and their interest to serve in the ward.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you can never underestimate the power of a thank you note, right? And
yeah.
And sometimes there is something powerful in not just sending an email, right? Not just sending a quick email or a text saying, hey, you know, you're doing great, like keep it going. But when you sit down and write with actual handwriting a note and then put it in the mail, put a stamp on it, and somebody gets that, like there's something nostalgic about getting a personal note or something in the mail that you actually want to get.
Right.
And I've tried that several times and just how people have appreciated that. And they feel like it's such on a personal level, like, wow, this person really knows me, you know, and even your example at the fair, going out of your way to to reach out to that sister. I mean, so many ways to do that. Powerful, powerful principle. Well, this has been fantastic. I'm curious. One thing I meant to ask you when we were talking about the characteristics of your ward, you say you have a Spanish group in your ward. Is that there's a handful of Spanish members and there's translation going on or interpretation going on during the meeting?
There is. We have we've had a Spanish group for just about since I got called, I think. So it's been about 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Actually,
so it's a newer thing for your ward.
It was right before I was called because I was in the stake, and the stake president was having a conversation one time with the Area 70, and there's a Spanish branch in the next town over. But you know, we said that, I think President Walker said that there was a couple families that were going over there, and he just looked at me and said, why don't you have a group? You know, why don't you start a group? So we did. And it got put in our ward, I think because we have less of those other issues, so we can focus on that. But yeah, we have a group leadership. They sometimes, I think once a month or so, they'll come into our meeting, our sacrament meeting, and they'll have translation equipment. But most of the time they have a separate meeting, and we have, depending if it's harvest time, you know, in the orchards or not, we have between 5 and 15 or 20 people. And so it's been neat. It's a different struggle because I don't speak Spanish. So it's been interesting dealing with that. My second counselor does. And so I delegate a lot of that to him, because he can communicate with them and he can have those conversations. And so he does a lot of the interviews and pops his head in and does those types of things. But it's been neat. It's been fun. We've got two sets of missionaries in our ward that are serving in our ward, and one of them is Spanish speaking. So they're just for the group. And, so yeah, it's been an interesting challenge. Our goal is to make it a branch in the next year or so, if we can, because that would allow them to have a priesthood leader that speaks Spanish and is there full time as the priesthood leader. We have our group leader, but he doesn't hold any keys. You know, he's not able to do the interviews. He's not able to do those things. He leads the meetings, but, you know, I think it'd be very beneficial to them to have a priesthood leader. So, that's our goal. But yeah, it's been interesting, and it's fun. It's a challenge. I've really understood, and I've talked to my counselors about this. You know, when you hear those stories in conference about, you know, the stories about the one family that worked for years and years and years, and they started the church in a country. And I understand that because, you know, it's so frustrating at times. You just feel like you're not getting anywhere. But then we had, you know, one of those families that joined, I think the wife was a member, the husband wasn't. He joined the church and they were sealed earlier this year. And, you know, when I was there for that sealing, it was the first time I'd been through a session in Spanish. That was interesting. But as I'm sitting there in the temple, I said, you know what? It's all worth it. It's okay. You know, all the struggle, all of the, you know, trying to get people to church, trying to help them to help themselves. Because it's tough. I mean, there's a lot of support that's, you know, from the ward, and there's a lot of leaders from the ward that are kind of supplementing it. And you don't want them to get used to that. You want them to be able to home teach themselves and do those things. So when they're a branch, they can do that. But at the same time, it's a struggle, and it's a lot of work. And I have nothing but respect for my group leadership because they put a ton of effort into supporting these members and encouraging them and helping them to grow in the gospel. And I'm sure within, you know, 10 or 20 years, we'll look back and we'll probably have a thriving ward and it'll be great. But for now, it's a struggle and it's a lot of hard work, but certainly worth it. And certainly a unique challenge, I guess, for us as a bishopric.
Yeah. Well, that's that'd be great to see that grow and fulfilling when you see the branch get organized and probably onto a ward after that. So, generally in these interviews, I like to ask just at the end, as far as any thoughts on home or visiting teaching, any unique approaches your ward takes or, that come to mind, or, is it pretty, you know, just get out there, assign and do your best to get everybody visited?
I think it's, there's been a big focus, and I think it's churchwide. You could tell me, but you know, on PPIs and again, that's been the biggest thing that we found is just the more often my high priest group leadership and my elders quorum presidency and my relief society presidency are talking, you know, and finding out from these home teachers and visiting teachers how their families are doing and what we can help with and those types of things that it goes better, that they are more likely to do it because, you know, none of us, myself included, likes being asked if we did something and then having to say, nope, I failed, you know? And so I think that's been the biggest thing for us is just doing that. And then we've tried really hard to make sure that it's a focus of our ward councils, of our fifth Sunday lessons at times, of sacrament meetings, and just keeping it in front of people. Because I think sometimes we get in this mentality of, well, you know, everybody knows they're supposed to do their home teaching. You know, we've talked about it a million times. Well, yeah, but until we're all doing it, then we need to keep talking about it. And so that's been one of the things, is just making sure we keep talking about it and focusing on it. PPIs has been another big thing. The other thing that I try to do as a bishop is, you know, I have every once in a while when I have a member struggling, I'll just flat ask them. I'm like, is there somebody that you would feel comfortable with as a home teacher? Is there somebody that you would, you know, because a lot of times I found that that's part of the problem. You know, it's like, I'm struggling. Well, yeah, I have home teachers, but I don't really get along with them, or we don't have anything in common. And that's not always the case. Sometimes we just need to suck it up and have who we have. But if somebody's struggling, I really feel like it's important that they have that support. And so it's recognizing that there are times that we need to make some changes, and we need to adjust who's home teaching who, and making sure that it's being done. The other thing that we've talked a lot about is the young men that are home teaching, and making sure that they have good role models that they're home teaching with. I think it's kind of the cultural thing where it's okay, you turn 14, you go home teaching with your dad, and that's fine if your dad goes home teaching. But I've been very clear with my elders quorum, my high priest groups, that if we have a dad that's not taking your son home teaching, then we switch it. You know, yeah, I understand that from ease of scheduling and planning and everything, it makes sense to have a father and a son go. I get that. But if you're not going, that's not good. You know, our young men need to have that experience of going home teaching every single month and looking after families and doing those things. And if that's not working with it being a father and a son, then they need to go with somebody else. And so that's been one of our focuses too, is just making sure that the youth have a good experience with home teaching, and that they see what the purpose of the responsibility is, so that when they become elders and high priests, they do it. they have that they have that practice and that habit already. So
that's great. That's great. Well, sorry, Lacey, are you still with us?
Yeah.
You're being so kind, and I can hear a faint, it sounds like your children are watching something in the background, right? I'm sure you're juggling a lot.
My son is, yeah.
That's great. Awesome. And I love these interviews that are just real. You know, do you live by a train track or something?
Did you hear that too?
Is that a train go by? It was very faint.
Okay.
But nonetheless, it's good to know that you're real people. But Lacey, I want to ask you, just to wrap up, as you look back in your time, you know, these last couple of years serving, and even in your development of the gospel last decade, how's this time serving, you know, with your husband as the bishop's wife, how's that made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
It's been probably the last couple months I've grown a ton. It's just made me more aware of what I need to do, you know, because I have my kids that need to have the example. Yeah, it's been in the last few months where I've grown, and I don't know if it's really been his calling that's helped me. Maybe it has a little bit, and I just don't know.
No, that's great. I love that. I love that, because it doesn't have to be his calling, right? It could be.
Right.
It's just the gospel, right? The way we're asked to serve and lead and hold that example. So, Mark, what about you? As you look back in the 2 years, obviously you've served in other capacities, but just this time as a bishop last 2 years, you know, being the leader, the father of the ward, how has it made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
I think before I answer that, I was just thinking sometimes Lacey's growth might be in spite of my calling.
Right.
Because it's a challenge. I mean, it really is sometimes. Yeah. So I think for me, the biggest things, there's been a few things that have really, really have been impressed upon me as I became bishop. One of the first ones was, I had a couple come to me like a week after I was called, with some issues that they were working through. And it was humbling to me to see the faith that they had in the office. It wasn't me. I mean, you know, they're coming and talking to me about things that you would never come and talk to a 29-year-old about. You just wouldn't. But they did. And it was so humbling, you know, after they'd leave my office, I would just sit there and just be blown away at the faith that the members have in their bishop. And, I think just that in itself makes you want to be a better person. It makes you want to, study harder and read more and pray harder and attend the temple more. It wants you to, you want to do those things because you see the way that, that the members look at you. And, you know, I'm very cognizant of the fact that they're not looking at me. They're looking at the mantle of the bishop. They're looking at the bishop. And when I'm not the bishop anymore, it'll be somebody else, but it makes you want to be better. I had a friend of mine that, you know, he, for a couple of months, every time he talked to me, he's like, oh, you're so great, you know, and you're so spiritual and all these things. And I had to stop him and say, look, I am the same person I was 2 months ago. Like, I have not changed any, except for the fact that, that I'm trying to be better. And, you know, I've had people ask me that question. It's like, well, you know, do you feel like you're more spiritual as the bishop? And it's like, yes, but you know, here's the caveat of that. 90% of that I could have done without being bishop. You know, 90% of it could have been, you know, I could have listened to Mormon Channel all the time before I was bishop, and I chose not to. You know, I could have prayed more. I could have read more. I could have attended the temple more. I could have done those things. And so I think part of it has just been a realization that, you know, as members, we're as spiritual as we want to be. And a calling doesn't make you spiritual. And I think the other thing, the other few things that have really affected me was just the love. Like, just, I remember it as a missionary a little bit, but I think it's been even more as bishop, just the love that you immediately have for people. And just, you know, like I said earlier, the charity, you know, and it really is, you know, when the scriptures talk about praying and asking Heavenly Father to give you charity, it really does happen. And, it's been amazing to just the love that I have for people, even people that get mad at me and people that are upset with me and stuff. I still love them. And I get frustrated with people sometimes too, but it's usually because I love them and I see the potential and I want them to be able to achieve their potential. And then I think it's, I don't know, it's being able to experience the atonement in a way that I never have. Dealing with the issues that bishops deal with, I was surprised at the weight that I felt immediately as I'm working with people and working through things. And, you know, we didn't talk about it today, but that's one of the things that Lacey's kind of struggled with is I'm a pretty happy person normally. I'm pretty upbeat and happy, but there are days that I come home and I'm just not because of things that I'm dealing with. And I didn't expect that. And I talked to my stake president and I said, I'm blown away. I didn't know this would happen. And he was like, oh yeah. He's like, you'll be up at 2 a.m. sometimes, just be prepared. You know, working through these things, but I've experienced, and I feel like, you know, as a bishop, I think you are, quote unquote blessed to feel a little bit of what people feel when they're struggling with something, whether it's, you know, working through the repentance process or something that happened to them that they had no control over, or, you know, just day-to-day life. I think every time somebody comes to talk to me, I carry a little bit of that and I feel a little bit of that. And I feel like in some small way, it's the Savior and Heavenly Father saying, here's what the Savior felt. Here's what it feels like to carry somebody's burdens just a little bit. And I'm not saying that a bishop's anywhere near what the Savior did, but I think we're given a glimpse of that. And I think that goes along with that charity. You know, it goes along with that, you know, as a bishop, I am up at night sometimes and I can't sleep because I'm worried about somebody and I'm asking, you know, I'm praying and asking Heavenly Father, what can I do? How can I help them? What can I say? What scripture can I share with them? What talk can I share with them? And you just worry about it. And I think that's been the thing that's drawn me, probably made me a better disciple, is just that experience of feeling the atonement from that side of it. And, you know, walking next to people and helping them through these challenges. And, you know, realizing that, you know, sometimes there's nothing you can do and people have to make their decisions and, but you still love them and you still want the best for them and you still worry about them and you're still up at night praying for them. And, you know, that's, I think it just changes your feelings towards other people and how you look at them. And I think it makes you a better person because you think of their feelings and you think of what they're going through. And as you do that, it allows you to have more charity. So I think that's been the biggest thing that's changed for me. And, it's been a learning experience and it's been a huge blessing. It's been, you know, for the most part, serving this calling has been a blessing and it's been awesome. There's the bad days, but the bad things that you deal with, but for the most part, it's been a huge blessing in our lives.
That concludes my interview with Mark and Lacey Sivercrop. What a fantastic couple. I mean, that Washington area of Ephrata is blessed to have them. And those types of couples are inspiring, right? Two converts who have just done their best to learn and develop in the gospel and now asked at such a young age to serve in these capacities. They're inspiring. And all those points and principles that Mark talked about and the perspective that Lacey had, I think will bless others' lives. Might be an interview to share with your wife if you are a bishop, and to hear from another bishop's wife and how she's dealing with that calling, you know, unofficial calling, and how she's approaching it. But it's inspiring for sure. And if you know of anybody else who I should interview, a couple, an individual, I want to definitely get, as I've said in the past, more sisters, more primary presidents, more Relief Society presidents, young women's presidents on the How I Lead segment. And because I know that there are many leaders out there in those capacities looking to hear how others are doing that calling and facing those problems and overcoming those problems, right? And so if you know of anybody that would be a great fit for the How I Lead segment, shoot me an email, let me know, and we'll reach out to them and see how we can make them feel most comfortable doing an interview like this. And I'd love to get their perspective. As always, all we ask is $1 a month for the content that we are putting out on Leading LDS. And if you're listening to this and you haven't donated anything, maybe just take a moment and ask why. Is it maybe the quality isn't there yet for you to feel like it's worth donating to and giving to? But if there is a reason why, no, I'd love to hear that. And that's going to be good feedback that I can work with and hopefully improve the content so you feel like you can give $1 a month. And if it is the fact that you just can't afford $1 a month, that's fine too. Maybe give it a penny a month, a quarter, something. I definitely want this to be a team effort, you know, something that we're all giving to and contributing to. And I don't expect everybody to take their turn, you know, hosting an interview or doing a summary or something like that. But if that's a way that you can contribute, you know, to do a summary or help me with the editing process or something like that, let me know. If that's a way you can contribute, great. But at least consider $1 a month, and that's going to go a long way to help us accomplish the mission and goals that we have in place at Leading LDS to enhance the leadership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so until next time, be a leader and not a calling.